attention to the babies here in Kalanga. They are all dying. Dying from kakakaka, the disease that turns the body to a small black pitcher, pitches it over, and pours out all its liquid insides. The heavy rains brought the disease down the streams and rivers. Everyone in this village knows more about hygiene than we do, we have lately discovered. While we were washing and swimming in the stream any old place, there were rules, it turns out. Wash clothes downstream, where the Forest Creek runs into the Crocodile River. Bathe in the middle. Draw water for drinking up above the village. In Kalanga, these are matters of religious observance. They are baptism and communion. Even defecation is ruled by African gods, who command that we use only the bushes that Tata Kuvudundu has sanctified for those purposes, and believe you me, he chooses bushes far away from the drinking water. Our latrine was probably neutral territory, but on the points of bathing and washing we were unenlightened for the longest time. We have offended all the oldest divinities in every thinkable way. Tata Nzolo, we sing, and I wonder what new disgusting sins we commit each day, holding our heads high in sacred ignorance while our neighbors gasp hand to mouth. Nelson says it was our offenses that brought on this rainy season. Oh, it rains, it pours, Noah himself would be dismayed. This rainy season has shattered all the rules. When it came early and lasted so long and poured down so hard, the manioc hills melted and tubers rotted away from their vines, and finally the downpour brought us the kakakaka. After all, even when everyone defecates righteously, there are villages upstream from us. Downstream is always someone else's up. The last shall be first. Now the thunderstorms have ended. The funerals are drying up as slowly as the puddles. Methuselah sits puny and still in his avocado tree with his eyes ticking back and forth, unprepared for a new season of overwhelming freedom. Beto nki tutasala, he mutters, sometimes in Mama Tatapa's ghost voice. What are we doing? It is a question anyone might ask. In the strange quiet, our family doesn't know what to do. Everyone else seems brain-dashed and busy at the same time, like dazed insects coming out after the storm. The women beat out their sisal mats and replant their fields while grieving for lost children. Anatole goes to our neighbors' houses, one by one, offering his condolences for our village's lost schoolboys. He is also, I have seen, preparing them for the election and independence. It is to be a kitchen election. Since no one can read, every candidate is designated by a symbol. Wisely, these men choose to represent themselves with useful things. Knife, bottle, matches, cooking pot. Anatole has set out in front of the school a collection of big clay bowls, and next to each one, the knife, the bottle, or the matches. On election day, every man in Kalanga is to throw in one pebble. The women tell their husbands constantly, the knife, the bottle, don't forget what I'm telling you. The men who get the privilege of voting seem the least interested. The old ones say independence is for the young, and perhaps this is true. The children seem most excited of all. They practice throwing pebbles into the bowls from across the yard. Anatole dumps these out at the end of each day. He sighs as the stones fall on the dirt in the shapes of new constellations. The make-believe votes of children. At the end of election day, Tata Ndu's sons will put the pebbles in bags along with the proper symbol for each candidate, knife, bottle, or matches, and carry them by canoe all the way upriver to Banningville. Pebbles from all over Congo will travel up rivers that day. Indeed, the earth shall move. A dugout canoe seems such a fragile bird to carry that weight. Turlexa Nebi, Ibn Axelrout, is traveling also. He wastes no time. These days he makes as many trips as he can up the Kwilu River to wherever he goes in the south, Katanga and Kasai, his radio says, where the mines are. He stops here every week just long enough to pay the women his nothing for their manioc and plantains, leaving them wailing like mourners at a funeral, flying away with whatever he can stuff into his sack while he can. The Belgians and the Americans who run the rubber plantations and copper mines, I imagine, are using larger sacks. The doctor-poet in our village is the Nganga Kuvudundu, I think. The rare nut, our father calls him, a thing, a seed to be cracked. The pot calls the kettle black. The Nganga Kuvudundu is writing poems for us alone. So much depends on the white chicken bones in the calabash bowl left standing in a puddle of rain outside our door. I saw him leave it there. I was looking out the window and he turned back just for a second, staring straight into my eyes. I saw a kindness there and believe he means to protect us, really. Protect us from angry gods and our own stupidity by sending us away. Bongo, bango, bingo. That is the story of Congo they are telling now in America, a tale of cannibals. I know about this kind of story. The lonely look down upon the hungry look down upon the starving. The guilty blame the damaged. Those of doubtful righteousness speak of cannibals, the unquestionably vile, the sinners, and the damned. It makes everyone feel much better. So, Khrushchev is said to be here dancing with the man-eating natives, teaching them to hate the Americans and the Belgians. It must be true, for how else would the poor Congolese know how to hate the Americans and the Belgians? After all, we have such white skin. We eat their food inside our large house and throw out the bones. Bones that lie helter-skelter on the grass, from which to tell our fortunes. Why ever should the Congolese read our doom? After all, we have offered to feed their children to the crocodiles in order for them to know the kingdom and the power and the glory. All the eyes of America know what a Congolese looks like. Skin and bones dancing, lips upcurled like oyster shells, a no-count man with a femur in his hair. The Nganga Kuvadundu, dressed in white with no bone in his hair, is standing at the edge of our yard. He of 11 toes. He repeats the end of his own name over and over, the word dundu. Dundu is a kind of antelope, or it is a small plant of the genus Veronia, or a hill, or a price you have to pay. So much depends on the tone of voice. One of these things is what our family has coming to us. Our Baptist ears from Georgia will never understand the difference. Rachel. Father flew with Eben Axelrod to Stanleyville for the same reason the bear went over the mountain, I guess, and all that he could see was the other side of the Congo. The other main reason for his trip was quinine pills, which we had just about run out of. How unfortunate. Quinine pills taste bad enough to give you a hair problem. I happen to know Ruth May doesn't even swallow hers all the time. Once I saw her hide it behind her side teeth when she opened wide to show Mother it was down the hatch. Then she spat it out in her hand and stuck it on the wall behind her cot. Me, I swallow. All I need is to go back home with some dread disease. Sweet 16 and never been kissed is bad enough, but to be Thyroid Mary on top of it, oh, brother. Father is mad at the underdowns. Usually they send the basic necessities they think we will need every month, which, believe you me, is not much. But this time they just sent a letter. Prepare your departure. We are sending a special mission plane for your evacuation June 28th. We are leaving Leopoldville the following week and have arranged for your family to accompany us as far as Belgium. The end? And the Price family lived happily ever after? Not on your life. Father's all psyched up to stay here forever, I think. Mother tries to explain to him day in and day out about how he is putting his own children in jeopardy of their lives, but he won't even listen to his own wife, much less his mere eldest daughter. I screamed and kicked the furniture until one whole leg came off the table and threw a hissy fit they could probably hear all the way to Egypt. Listen, what else can a girl do but try? Stay here when everybody else gets to go home and do the bunny hop and drink Cokes? It is a sheer tapestry of justice. Father returned from Stanleyville with his hair just about standing on end. He was so full of the daily news. They had their election, I guess, and the winner is a man named Patrice, if you can believe. Patrice Lumumba. Father said Lumumba's party won 35 of 100-some-odd seats in the new parliament, mainly because of his natural animal magnetism, and also the large population of his hometown. Sounded kind of like student council elections at Bethlehem High, where whoever has the biggest clique of friends, they win. Not that a minister's daughter would ever have a chance, gee, so man. No matter how much you flirt or carry on like a cool cat and roll up your skirt waistband on the bus, they still just think you're L7, a square, in other words. Try to get a boyfriend under those conditions. Believe you me, your chances are dull and void. So Mr. Patrice will be the Prime Minister of the Congo now, and it won't be the Belgian Congo anymore. It will be the Republic of Congo. And do you think anybody in this hip town we live in is actually going to notice? Oh, sure. They'll all have to go out and get their driver's licenses changed. In the year 2 million, that is, when they build a road to here and somebody gets a car. Mother said, now is he the one they're saying is a communist? Father said, not so's you'd notice. That is the one and only Mississippi expression he has ever picked up from Mother. We'll ask her something like, did you iron my linen dress like I asked you to? And she'll say, not so's you'd notice. Back home, she could be a smart aleck sometimes, and how, when Father wasn't around, that is. Father said he heard soon-to-be Prime Minister Lumumba talk on a radio in a barbershop in Stanleyville about neutral foreign policy and African unity and all that jazz. He says now Patrice Lumumba and the other elected Congolese are trading chickens and eggs to set up a government that everybody in the parliament will go along with. But the problem is all of them still like their own tribes and their own chiefs the best. I can just picture the parliament room, 100-some-odd Tata Ndus in pointy hats and no-glass glasses, all flicking flies away with animal-tail magic wands in the sweltering heat, pretending to ignore each other. It will probably take them 100 years just to decide which person gets to sit where. It's enough already. All I want is to go home and start scrubbing the deep-seated impurities of the Congo out of my skin. Ruth May. Mama needs her some quick energy. After Father went away with Leah on the plane, she went and got in her bed and won't get up. It wasn't the Mr. Axelrod plane. He goes and comes whenever he feels like it. This was another airplane, just as little but yellow this time. The driver had on a white shirt and Vitalis in his hair that you could smell. He smelled clean. He had experiment gum and gave me a piece. He was a white man that talked French. Sometimes some of them do, and I don't know why. We all put on our shoes and went down to see the airplane land. I have to wear white baby shoes even though I'm not a baby. When I'm grown, my mother will still have my shoes. She aims to turn them into brown, shiny metal and keep them on the table in Georgia with my baby picture. She did it for all the others, even Ada and her one-foot snow count. It curls up and makes the shoe wear out funny. Even that bad, sideways, worn-out shoe Mama made into metal and saved, so she'll save mine. Mama said the airplane was a special chart plane the underdown sent for us to get all our stuff that needed getting and flying out of here. But Father wouldn't allow. Only he and Leah got on and didn't take anything because they're coming back. Rachel sassed him straight to his face and tried to climb right into the airplane with her things. He flung her back. She threw her stuff on the ground and said fine, then she was going to go drown herself in the river. But we knew she wouldn't. Rachel wouldn't want to get that dirty. Ada wasn't there either. She stayed home. Just me and Mama stood on the field to watch the plane fly away. But Mama wouldn't even jump up and wave goodbye. She just stood with her face getting smaller and smaller, and when you couldn't see the airplane anymore, she went in the house and lay down on her bed. It was morning, not night, not even nap time. I told Rachel and Ada we needed some 7-Up for Mama. Rachel does the radio advertisements from back home, and that is one. Bushed, beet, need ionizing. 7-Up is the greatest discovery yet for getting new energy quick. In 2 to 6 minutes, you'll feel like a new you. But all day went by and it got dark and Mama still doesn't feel like a new Mama. Rachel won't talk to me about getting 7-Up. She's sitting out on the porch looking at the hole in the sky where the airplane went away. And Ada doesn't talk anyway because of how she is. Nelson got us our dinner, but he's sneaking around the house like somebody got in a fight and he's staying out of it. So it's real quiet. I tried to play, but I didn't feel like it. I went in and picked up Mama's hand and it fell back down. Then I just crawled in the bed with her, and now that makes two of us that don't feel like getting up ever again. Leah. My father and I have patched things up. He allowed me to accompany him to Leopoldville, where we got to see history in the making. We watched the independence ceremonies from a giant rusty barge tied to the bank of the Congo River that was loaded with so many pushing, squirming people, Mrs. Underdown said we'd probably all go down like the Titanic. It was such an important event, King Baudouin of Belgium himself was going to be there. It was childish, I know, but I got very excited when she told me that. I suppose I was picturing someone in a crown and an ermine-trimmed scarlet robe like old King Cole. But the white men sitting up on the stage were all dressed alike in white uniforms with belts, swords, shoulder fringe, and white flat-top military hats. Not a single crown to be seen. As they waited their turn to speak, dark sweat stains blossomed under the arms of their uniforms. And when it was all over, I couldn't even tell you which one had been the king. The white men mostly spoke of the glorious days of the previous king of Belgium, King Leopold, who first made the Congo into what it is today. Mrs. Underdown reported this to me in quick little bursts of translation while she squeezed my hand tightly, since it was mostly all in French. I didn't care for her holding my hand. I am as tall as she is and a good sight less of a scaredy cat. But we could have gotten lost from one another and all those people, too, and Father wouldn't have held my hand for the world. He isn't like that. Mrs. Underdown called me a poor lost lamb. She couldn't believe it when Father and I showed up without the rest of them. Her jaw dropped to her bosom. Later, when we were alone, she told me it was her opinion that Father was not in his right mind and should think of his poor children. I told her my father would know what was best in the sight of the Lord, and that we were privileged to serve. Why, that just flabbergasted her. She's a meek woman, and I can't say that I respect her. They are leaving tomorrow to go to Belgium, and we're going back to Kalanga to hold the fort until another family can come. That is Father's plan. Reverend Underdown is pretending not to be mad at us. After the king and the other white men spoke, they inaugurated Patrice Lumumba as the new prime minister. I could tell exactly which one he was. He was a thin, distinguished man who wore real eyeglasses and a small pointed beard. When he stood up to speak, everyone's mouth shut. In the sudden quiet, we could hear the great Congo River lapping up its banks. Even the birds seemed taken aback. Patrice Lumumba raised his left hand up and seemed to grow 10 feet tall right there and then. His eyes shone bright white with dark centers. His smile was a triangle upcurved on the sides and reaching a point below like his beard. I could see his face very clearly even though we were far away. "Ladies and gentlemen of the Congo," he said, "who have fought for the independence won today, I salute you." The quiet crowd broke open with cheers and cheers. Je vous salue encore! Patrice Lumumba asked us to keep this day, June 30th, 1960, in our hearts forever and tell our children of its meaning. Everyone on the raft and the crowded banks would do what he said, I knew, even me if I ever get to have any children. Whenever he paused to take a breath, the people screamed and waved their arms. First, he talked about our equal partner, Belgium. Then he said other things that made Mrs. Underdown nervous. "Our lot was 80 years of colonial rule," she translated, and then she stopped. She let go my hand, wiped it on her slacks, and grabbed me again. "What all's he saying?" I asked her. I didn't want to miss word one of Patrice Lumumba. As he spoke, his eyes seemed to be on fire. I have seen preachers at revival meetings speak like that, with voices rising in such a way that heaven and anger get mingled together. The people cheered more and more. "He's saying we despoiled their land and used the Negroes for slaves just as long as we could get away with it," she said. "We did that?" "Well, the Belgians in general. He's very mad about all the nice things they said earlier about King Leopold, who was a bad egg, I'll admit that." "Oh," I said. I narrowed my eyes to a hard focus on Patrice Lumumba and tried to understand his words. I was jealous of Ada, who picked up languages easier than she could tie her own shoes. I wished I'd studied harder. "We have known les maisons magnifiques for the whites in the cities and the falling down houses for the Negroes." Oh, I understood that all right. He was right. I'd seen it myself when we went to the Underdowns. Leopoldville is a nice little town of dandy houses with porches and flowery yards on nice paved streets for the whites, and surrounding it for miles and miles nothing but dusty run-down shacks for the Congolese. They make their homes out of sticks or tin or anything in the world they can find. Father said that is the Belgians' doing, and Americans would never stand for this kind of unequal treatment. He says after independence, the Americans will send foreign aid to help them make better houses. The Underdown's house has soft red Persian rugs, chairs with matching ottomans, even a radio. She had a real China tea set on the dark wooden sideboard. Last night I watched her pack up all the fragile cups, moaning about what she'd have to leave and who'd get it. For dinner, the houseboy brought us one thing after another until I thought I'd burst. Real meat, orange cheeses wrapped in red wax, canned yellow asparagus. After 100 white meals of fufu bread, potato buds, and carnation milk, it was too much taste and color for me. I chewed and swallowed slowly, feeling sick. After dinner, why, chocolate cookies from France. The Underdown's two sons, big crew-cut boys shifting around in grown men's bodies, grabbed handfuls of cookies with their big hands and bolted from the table. I took only one and couldn't get my mouth to eat it, though I wanted to badly. The Underdown's skinny houseboy sweated in his ironed white apron while he hurried to bring us more things. I thought about the kilo of sugar he'd tried to stash under his shirt. With so much else around, why wouldn't Mrs. Underdown just go ahead and give it to him? Was she actually going to take all her sugar back to Belgium? "Tomorrow she'll be gone, and I'll still be here," I thought to myself as we stood on our barge fastened to the bank of the Congo, watching history. A rat ran under the bare feet of some people standing near us, but no one paid any attention. They just cheered. Patrice Lumumba had stopped speaking for a moment to take off his glasses and mop his forehead with a white handkerchief. He wasn't sweating in his dark suit the way the white men had stained their white uniforms, but his face gleamed. "Tell me what he's saying," I pleaded with Mrs. Underdown. "I've only gone as far as the past perfect tense in my French book." Mrs. Underdown relented after a while and told me certain sentences. Much of the rest of it began to come to me in bursts of understanding, as if Patrice Lumumba were speaking in tongues and my ears had been blessed by the same stroke of grace. "My brothers," he said, "mes frères, we have suffered the colonial oppression in body and heart, and we say to you all of that is finished. Together we are going to make a place for justice and peace, prosperity and grandeur. We are going to show the world what the homme noir can do when he works for freedom. We are going to make the Congo, for all of Africa, the heart of light." I thought I would go deaf from the roaring. Ada. Imulp der Ino, one red plume. So much depends on the single red feather I saw when I stepped out of the latrine. It is early morning now, rooster pink sky, smoky air, morning. Long shadows scissoring the road from here to anywhere. Independence Day, June 30th. Does anyone here know about the new freedom? These women, squatting, knees wide apart in their long wrapped skirts, throwing handfuls of pepper and small potatoes into hissing pans over cooking fires. These children defecating earnestly or weakly according to their destiny in the bushes. One red feather for celebration. No one yet has seen it but me. When Miss Dickinson says hope is the thing with feathers, I always think of something round, a ball from one of the games I will never play, stuck all around like a clove orange sachet with red feathers. I have pictured it many times, hope, wondering how I would catch such a thing one-handed if it did come floating down to me from the sky. Now I find it has fallen already, and a piece of it is here beside our latrine, one red plume. In celebration, I stoop down to pick it up. Down in the damp grass, I saw the red shaft of another one, and I reached for it. Following the trail, I found first the red and then the gray, clusters of long wing feathers still attached to gristle and skin, splayed like fingers. Downy pale breast feathers in tufted mounds. Methuselah. At last it is Independence Day for Methuselah and the Congo. O Lord of the feathers, deliver me this day. After a lifetime caged away from flight and truth comes freedom. After long seasons of slow preparation for an innocent death, the world is theirs at last. From the carnivores that would tear me, breast from wishbone. Set upon by the civet cat, the spy, the eye, the hunger of a superior need, Methuselah is free of his captivity at last. This is what he leaves to the world. Gray and scarlet feathers strewn over the damp grass. Only this and nothing more, the telltale heart, tale of the carnivore. None of what he was taught in the house of the master. Only feathers without the ball of hope inside. Feathers at last, and no words at all. Book 3, The Judges. And ye shall make no league with the inhabitants of this land. Ye shall throw down their altars. They shall be as thorns in your sides, and their gods shall be a snare unto you. Judges 2:2-3. Orleana Price, Sanderling Island, Georgia. Listen, little beast. Judge me as you will, but first, listen. I am your mother. What happened to us could have happened anywhere to any mother. I'm not the first woman on earth to have seen her daughters possessed. For time and eternity there have been fathers like Nathan who simply can see no way to have a daughter but to own her like a plot of land, to work her, plow her under, rain down a dreadful poison upon her. Miraculously, it causes these girls to grow. They elongate on the pale, slender stalks of their longing like sunflowers with heavy heads. You can shield them with your body and soul, trying to absorb that awful rain, but they'll still move toward him. Without cease, they'll bend to his light. Oh, a wife may revile such a man with every silent curse she knows, but she can't throw stones. A stone would fly straight through him and strike the child made in his image, clipping out an eye or a tongue or an outstretched hand. It's no use. There are no weapons for this fight. There are countless laws of man and of nature, and none of these is on your side. Your arms go weak in their sockets, your heart comes up empty. You understand that the thing you love more than this world grew from a devil's seed. It was you who let him plant it. The day does come, finally, when a daughter can walk away from a man such as that, if she's lucky. His own ferocity turns over inside her, and she turns away hard, never to speak to him again. Instead, she'll begin talking to you, her mother, demanding with a world of indignation, how could you let him? Why? There are so many answers. All of them are faultless, and none good enough. What did I have? No money, that's for sure. No influence, no friends I could call upon in that place, no way to overrule the powers that governed our lives. This is not a new story. I was an inferior force. There was another thing, too, awful to admit. I'd come to believe that God was on his side. Does this make me seem lunatic? But I did believe it. I must have. I feared him more than it's possible to fear a mere man. Feared him, loved him, served him, clamped my hands over my ears to stop his words that rang in my head even when he was far away or sleeping. In the depths of my sleepless nights I would turn to the Bible for comfort, only to find myself regaled yet again. Unto the woman God said, I will greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children, and thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. Oh, mercy! If it catches you in the wrong frame of mind, the King James Bible can make you want to drink poison in no uncertain terms. My downfall was not predicted. I didn't grow up looking for ravishment or rescue, either one. My childhood was a happy one in its own bedraggled way. My mother died when I was quite young, and certainly a motherless girl will come up wanting in some respects. But in my opinion, she has a freedom unknown to other daughters. For every womanly fact of life she doesn't get told, a star of possibility still winks for her on the horizon. Jackson, Mississippi in the Great Depression wasn't so different from the Congo 30 years later, except that in Jackson we knew of some that had plenty, and I guess that did make us restless from time to time. In Kalanga, people knew nothing of things they might have had, a Frigidaire, a washer-dryer combination. Really, they'd sooner imagine a tree that could pull up its feet and go bake bread. It didn't occur to them to feel sorry for themselves, except when children died. Then they wept and howled. Anyone can recognize the raging injustice there. But otherwise, I believe they were satisfied with their lot. And so it was for me, as a child in the Depression, with that same practical innocence. So long as I was surrounded only with what I knew, that's what life had to offer, and I took it. As a noticeably pretty child and later on a striking girl, I had my own small way in the world. My father, Bud Wharton, was an eye doctor. We lived on the outskirts of Jackson proper in a scrubby settlement called Pearl. Dad saw patients in the back room of the house, which had metal cabinets for his nested lenses that tinkled like glass wind chimes when you opened and shut the drawers. Up front, we ran a store. We had to, because in hard times, everyone's eyes get better, or at least good enough. In the store, we sold fresh produce my cousins brought in from their truck farm, and also dry goods and a little ammunition. We squeaked by. We all lived upstairs. At one time, there were 11 altogether, cousins from Noxubee County, uncles who came and went with the picking season, and my old Aunt Tess. She was a mother to me if I needed one. What Aunt Tess loved to say was, "Sugar, it's no parade, but you'll get down the street one way or another, so you'd just as well throw your shoulders back and pick up your pace." And that was more or less what we all believed in. I don't think Dad ever forgave me later on for becoming a Free Will Baptist. He failed to see why anyone would need more bluster and testimony about God's plan than what he found, for example, within the fine-veined world of an eyeball. That and a good chicken dinner on Sundays. Dad drank and cursed some, but not in any way that mattered. He taught me to cook and otherwise let me run wild with my cousins. On the outskirts of Pearl lay a wilderness. There we discovered pitcher plant bogs where we'd hike up our dresses, sink on our knees in the rich black muck, and stare carnivory right in the lips, feeding spiders to the pitcher plants. This was what I worshipped and adored as a child, miracles of a passionate nature. Later on we discovered kissing boys, then tent revivals. It was some combination of all those things that ran me up against Nathan Price. I was 17, bursting utterly with happiness. Arm in arm, we girls marched forward in our thin cotton dresses with all eyes upon us. Tossing our hair down the aisle, we went between the rows of folding chairs borrowed from the funeral home, right straight to the front of the crowded tent for the Lord's roll call. We threw ourselves at Jesus with our unsaved bosoms heaving. We had already given a chance to all the other redneck hooligans in Pearl by then and were looking for someone who better deserved us. Well, why not Jesus? We were only in it for the short run anyhow. We assumed he would be gone by the end of the week, the same as all the others. But when the tent folded up, I found I had Nathan Price in my life instead, a handsome young red-haired preacher who fell upon my unclaimed soul like a dog on a bone. He was more sure of himself than I'd thought it possible for a young man to be, but I resisted him. His seriousness dismayed me. He could be jolly with old ladies in crepe de chine dresses, patting their hunched backs, but with me he could not let go the subject of heaven except to relieve it occasionally with his thoughts on hell. Our courtship crept up on me, mainly because I didn't recognize that's what it was. I thought he was just bound and determined to save me. He'd park himself on our dusty front porch steps, fold his suit jacket neatly on the glider, roll up his sleeves, and read to me from the Psalms and Deuteronomy while I shelled beans. "How say ye to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain?" The words were mysterious and beautiful, so I let him stay. My prior experience with young men was to hear them swear, "Christ Almighty in the crap house," at any dress with too many buttons. Now here was one from whose mouth came, "The words of the Lord are pure words, as silver tried in a furnace of earth, purified 7 times, and he maketh me to lie down in green pastures." Oh, I wanted those green pastures. I could taste the pale green sweetness of the blade of wheat stripped and sucked between my teeth. I wanted to lie down with those words and rise up speaking a new language. So I let him stay. As a young and ambitious revival preacher, his circuit was supposed to divide him equally between Rankin, Simpson, and Copiah counties. But I'll tell you what, more souls got saved in Pearl that summer than the Lord probably knew what to do with. Nathan hardly missed a Sunday chicken dinner at our house. Aunt Tess finally said, "You're feeding him anyways, child. Why not go on and marry him if that's what he's after?" I suppose I'll never know if that was what he was after. But when I told him Aunt Tess was more or less needing an answer before committing more chickens to the project, the idea of marriage suited him well enough so that he owned it as his. I hardly had time to think about my own answer, why it was taken to be a foregone conclusion. And even if anyone had been waiting for my opinion, I wouldn't have known how to form one. I'd never known any married person up close. What did I know of matrimony? From where I stood, it looked like a world of flattering attention and what's more, a chance to cross the county line. We married in September and spent our honeymoon picking cotton for the war effort. In 39 and 40, there had been such talk of war, the boys were getting called up just to make a show of being ready for anything, I suppose. But Nathan had always been exempted as an indispensable worker, not for the Lord, but for King Cotton. He did farm labor between revivals, and in the autumn of 41, it was our first enterprise as newlyweds to bend our backs together in the dusty fields. When the rough cotton pokes were filled, our hands clawed raw and our hair and shoulders tufted with white, we believed we'd done our part. Never did we dream that shortly the bombs would fall on a faraway harbor whose name struck a chill across our own small, landlocked Pearl. By the end of that infamous week, half the men in all this world were pledged to a single war, Nathan included. He was drafted. At Fort Sill, his captain made note of Nathan's faith and vouched that he'd serve as a hospital cleric or chaplain decently removed from enemy lines. I let out my breath. Now I could truly say I loved the Lord. But then, without any explanation, Nathan found himself in Paris, Texas, training for the infantry. I was allowed to spend 2 weeks with him there on the windswept plain, mostly waiting in the strange vacancy of a cold apartment, trying to compose cordial things to say to the other wives. What flotsam and jetsam we were, women of all accents and prospects, washed up there boiling grits or pasta, whatever we knew as comfort, united by our effort not to think about our husband's hands learning to cradle a gun. At night, I cradled his head on my lap and read him the scriptures. "The Lord is my rock and my fortress, the horn of my salvation. So shall I be saved from mine enemies." When he left, I went home to Pearl. He wasn't even gone 3 months. He was trucked, shipped, and shuttled on the Asiatic fleet and finally encamped under palm trees on the Philippine shore to make his stand for General MacArthur. His company fought their way into Luzon, facing nothing worse than mosquitoes and jungle to begin with, but on their second night were roused from sleep by artillery. Nathan was struck in the head with a shell fragment. He ran for cover, dazed, and spent the night in a bamboo pig shed. He had suffered a concussion but gradually regained consciousness through the dawn and staggered about half-blinded into the open, with no more sense of direction than an insect rushing at flame. By pure luck, just before nightfall, he was spotted on the beach and picked up by a PT boat. From a hospital bunker in Corregidor Island, he wrote me a cheerful V-mail letter about his salvation by the grace of God in a Jap hog manger. He couldn't tell his location, of course, but promised me he was miraculously mostly intact and coming home soon. That was the last I would ever hear from the man I'd married, one who could laugh even about sleeping in a manger, call me his honey lamb, and trust in the miracle of good fortune. I can still picture the young soldier who wrote that letter while propped up in bed, smiling through his eye patch and bandages, showing the nurses a photo of his pretty bride with Delta cotton poking out of her hair, enjoying, as it turned out, the last happy hours of his life. He hadn't yet learned what happened to the rest of his company. In a few days, the news would begin to reach Corregidor. Through the tunnels of that island fortress came wind of a horror too great to speak aloud, a whispered litany that would take years to be fully disclosed to the world, and especially to me. It would permanently curl one soldier's heart like a piece of hard shoe leather. When the shelling began that night, as Nathan was hit and stumbled unseen through the darkness into a pig shed, the company received orders to move quickly to the Bataan Peninsula, where they could hide in the jungle, regroup, then march back to retake Manila. It was an error of a commander's overconfidence, small in history, large in the lives of those men. They were trapped on the peninsula, starving and terrified, and finally rounded up at Bayonet Point to be marched north through tepid rice paddies and blazing heat, marched through exhaustion and sickness and beyond it, marched from their feet to their hands and knees, emaciated, hallucinating from thirst, and racked with malaria, toward a prison camp which few of them ever reached, and fewer survived. Nathan's company died to the man on the death march from Bataan. Private Price was evacuated from Corregidor just a few weeks before MacArthur himself abandoned that post with his famous promise to return. But he would not be back, so far as those boys in Bataan were concerned, and neither would the soldier boy I'd married. He came home with a crescent-shaped scar on his temple, seriously weakened vision in his left eye, and a suspicion of his own cowardice from which he could never recover. His first words to me were to speak of how fiercely he felt the eye of God upon him. He pulled away from my kiss and my teasing touch, demanding, "Can't you understand the Lord is watching us?" I'd still tried to tell him we were lucky. I believed the war had made only the smallest possible dent in our plans. Nathan was changed, I could see, but he only seemed more devout, and it was hard to name the ruin in that. At last I'd get to cross the state lines I'd dreamed of, traveling as a minister's wife. Lord have mercy, that I did. Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia. We crossed lines in sand drawn through palmetto scrub, lines down the middle of highways, soup kitchen lines, lines of worry, souls lined up awaiting the burning tongue of salvation. Nathan aimed to scorch a path as wide as Sherman's. With no money and no time to settle, we moved to a different ramshackle rental cottage or boarding house every season until I was so pregnant with Rachel that our nomad state seemed disreputable. One night we simply chose Bethlehem, Georgia off a map. By good luck or providence, our station wagon made it that far, and Bethlehem turned out to be an open market for evangelical Baptists. I tried to laugh about it, for here we were, man and swollen wife, and no more room at the inn. Nathan did not laugh at that hopeful comparison. In fact, it brought his hand down against me for the first time. I recall that I was sitting on the edge of a chair in our still-unpacked kitchen, holding my huge body together with both hands as we listened to the radio. A man had been reading a long war story, as they did then, a first-hand account of a prison camp and a dreadful march where exhausted men struggled hopelessly, fell behind, and perished in brief orange bursts of pistol fire in the darkness. I was only half listening until Nathan brought me to attention. "Not one of those men will ever see a son born to carry on his name, and you dare to gloat before Christ himself about your undeserved blessing?" Until that night, I'd never known the details of where Nathan had been, nor the full measure of what he was still escaping. He was profoundly embarrassed by my pregnancies. To his way of thinking, they were unearned blessings, and furthermore, each one drew God's attention anew to my having a vagina and his having a penis, and the fact we'd laid them near enough together to conceive a child. But God knows it was never so casual as that. Nathan was made feverish by sex, and trembled afterward, praying aloud and blaming me for my wantonness. If his guilt made him a tyrant before men, it made him like a child before his God. Not a helpless or pleading child, but a petulant one, the type of tough boy who's known too little love and is quick to blame others for his mistakes. The type who grows up determined to show them all what he can do. He meant personally to save more souls than had perished on the road from Bataan, I think, and all other paths ever walked by the blight of mankind. And where was I, the girl or woman called Orleana, as we traveled those roads and crossed the lines again and again? Swallowed by Nathan's mission, body and soul. Occupied as if by a foreign power. I still appeared to be myself from the outside, I'm sure, just as he still looked like the same boy who'd gone off to war. But now every cell of me was married to Nathan's plan, his magnificent will. This is how conquest occurs. One plan is always larger than the other. I tried hard to do what I believed a wife ought, things like washing white shirts and black socks separately in rooming house sinks, making meal after meal of fried corn mush. The towns where we preached were stripped bare of young men, with it still being wartime, and this fanned the fires of Nathan's private torture. When he looked out over those soldierless congregations, he must have seen ghosts marching north. For my part, I merely watched young, deprived female bosoms panting before my handsome husband, soldier of the Lord. I longed to shout, "Go ahead and try him, girls. I am too tired." Or else I was home waiting for him, drinking four glasses of water before he arrived, so I could watch him eat whatever there was without my stomach growling. When I was carrying the twins, I had such desperate cravings I sometimes went out at night on my hands and knees and secretly ate dirt from the garden. Three babies in less than 2 lonely years I had. I cannot believe any woman on earth has ever made more babies out of less coition. Three babies were too much, and I sensed it deep in my body. When the third one was born, she could not turn her head to the side or even properly suckle. That was Ada. I'd cried for days when I learned I was carrying twins, and now I lay awake nights wondering whether my despair had poisoned her. Already Nathan's obsession with guilt and God's reproof was infecting me. Ada was what God sent me, either as punishment or reward. The world has its opinion on that, and I have mine. The doctors gave her little hope, though one of the nurses was kind. She told me formula was the very best thing, a modern miracle, but we couldn't afford it for two. So I ended up suckling greedy Leah at my breast and giving Ada the expensive bottles, both at the same time. With twins, you learn how to do everything backhanded. Not only twins, mind you, but also a toe-headed toddler whose skin seemed too thin, for she wailed at the slightest discomfort. Rachel screamed every single time she wet her diaper and set the other two off like alarm bells. She also screamed excessively over teething. Ada howled from frustration, and Leah cried over nightmares. For 6 years, from age 19 until I turned 25, I did not sleep uninterrupted through a single night. There it is. And you wonder why I didn't rise up and revolt against Nathan? I felt lucky to get my shoes on the right feet, that's why. I moved forward only, thinking each morning anew that we were leaving the worst behind. Nathan believed one thing above all else, that the Lord notices righteousness and rewards it. My husband would accept no other possibility. So if we suffered in our little house on the peanut plain of Bethlehem, it was proof that one of us had committed a failure of virtue. I understood the failure to be mine. Nathan resented my attractiveness, as if slender hips and large blue eyes were things I'd selected intentionally to draw attention to myself. The eyes of God were watching, he gave me to know. If I stood still for a moment in the backyard between hanging up sheets to notice the damp grass tingling under my bare feet, his eyes observed my idleness. God heard whenever I let slip one of my father's curse words, and he watched me take my bath, daring me to enjoy the warm water. I could scarcely blow my nose without feeling watched. As if to compensate for all this watching, Nathan habitually overlooked me. If I complained about our life, he would chew his dinner while looking tactfully away, as one might ignore a child who had deliberately broken her dolls and then whine she has nothing to play with. To save my sanity, I learned to pad around hardship in soft slippers and try to remark on its good points. If there was still some part of a beautiful heathen girl in me, a girl drawn to admiration like a moth to moonlight, and if her heart still pounded on Georgia nights when the peeper frogs called out from roadside ditches, she was too dumbfounded to speak up for herself. Once or twice, while Nathan was away on a revival, I may have locked the doors and breathed into my own mouth in the mirror, putting on red lipstick to do the housework. But rarely. I encountered my own spirit less and less. By the time Ruth May was born, we'd moved into the parsonage on Hale Street, and Nathan was in full possession of the country once known as Orleana Wharton. I accepted the Lord as my personal Savior, for he finally brought me a Maytag washer. I rested in this peace and called it happiness. Because in those days, you see, that's how a life like mine was known. It took me a long time to understand the awful price I'd paid, and that even God has to admit the worth of freedom. How say ye to my soul, flee as a bird to your mountain? By then, I was lodged in the heart of darkness, so thoroughly bent to the shape of marriage I could hardly see any other way to stand. Like Methuselah, I cowered beside my cage, and though my soul hankered after the mountain, I found, like Methuselah, I had no wings. That is why, little beast, I'd lost my wings. Don't ask me how I gained them back. The story is too unbearable. I trusted too long in false reassurances, believing, as we all want to when men speak of the national interest, that it's also ours. In the end, my lot was cast with the Congo. Poor Congo, barefoot bride of men who took her jewels and promised the kingdom. The Things We Didn't Know. Kalanga, September 1960. Leah. For the second time, we flew from Leopoldville over the jungle and down into that tiny cleared spot that was called Kalanga. This time, it was just Father and me in the airplane, plus Mr. Axelroot and 20 pounds of dry goods and canned whole prunes the underdowns couldn't take with them when they fled the Congo. But this second bumpy touchdown didn't have the same impact as our first arrival. Instead of excitement, I felt a throb of dread. Not a single soul was standing at the edge of the field to greet us. No villagers, not even Mother or my sisters. This much is for sure, nobody was pounding on drums or stewing up a goat for us. As Father and I crossed the lonely field and made for our house, I couldn't help but think about that earlier night and the welcome feast, all the tastes and sounds of it. How strange and paltry it seemed at the time, and now, looking back, what an abundance of good protein had been sacrificed in our honor. A shameful abundance, really. My stomach growled. I silently pledged to the Lord that I would express true gratitude for such a feast if ever one should happen again. Rachel's opinion of goat meat notwithstanding, we sure could use a good old feast, because how else were we going to eat now? You can only get so far in this life on canned whole prunes. On account of independence, I'd been thinking more about money than ever before in my life, aside from story problems for sixth grade math. $50 a month in Belgian francs might not sound like much, but in Kalanga it had made us richer than anybody. Now we are to get by on $0 a month in Belgian francs, and it doesn't take long to figure out that story problem. Sure enough, within a few weeks of Father's and my empty-handed return, the women figured out we had no money and stopped coming to our door to sell us the meat or fish their husbands had killed. It was a gradual understanding, of course. At first they were just confused by our lowered circumstances. We spelled out our position as best we could. Fiata, no money. This was the truth. Every franc we'd saved up had gone to Eben Axelrod because Father had to bribe him flat out to fly the two of us back from Leopoldville. Yet our neighbors in Kalanga seemed to think, could this really be a white person fiata? They would remain in our doorway for the longest time, just staring us up and down, while their baskets of plenty loomed silently on their heads. I suppose they must have thought our wealth was infinite. Nelson explained again and again, with Rachel and Ada and me looking over his shoulder, that it was independence now and our family didn't get paid extra for being white Christians. Well, the women made lots of sympathetic noises upon hearing that. They bounced their babies on their hips and said, Abu. Well then, Ayi, the independence. But they still didn't quite believe it. Had we looked everywhere they wanted to know? Perhaps there is still a little money stashed under those strange tall beds or inside our cabinet boxes. And the little boys still attacked us like good-natured bandits whenever we went outside. Cadeau, cadeau, demanding powdered milk or a pair of pants, insisting that we still had a whole slew of these things stashed away at home. Mama Mwanza, from next door, was the only one who felt sorry for us. She made her way over on the palms of her hands to give us some oranges, independence or not. We told her we didn't have a thing to give her back, but she just waved up at us with the heels of both her hands. Abu, no matter. Her little boys were good at finding oranges, she said, and she still had a Bakala Mpandi at her house, a good strong man. He was going to set his big fish traps later in the week, and if the catch was good, he would let her bring us some fish. Whenever you have plenty of something, you have to share it with the fiata, she said. And Mama Mwanza is not even Christian. Really, you know things are bad when a woman without any legs and who recently lost two of her own kids feels sorry for you. Mother was taking life hard. The last we knew, when Father and I took off on the plane for Leopoldville, she was still trying to rise to the occasion. But in the short time we were away, she'd stopped rising and gone downhill. Now she tended to walk bewildered around the house in her nightgown, scuffed brown loafers, no socks, and an unbuttoned pink blouse, spending both nights and days only halfway dressed for either one. A lot of the time she spent curled up on the bed with Ruth May. Ruth May didn't want to eat and said she couldn't stand upright because she was sweating too much. The truth is, neither one of them was taking a healthy interest. Nelson told me confidentially that Mother and Ruth May had kibaatsu, which means that someone had put a curse on them. Furthermore, he claimed he knew who it was, and that sooner or later the kibaatsu would get around to all the females in our house. I thought of the chicken bones in the calabash bowl left on our doorstep by Tata Kuvadundu some weeks back, which had given me the creeps. I explained to Nelson that his voodoo was absolutely nonsense. We don't believe in an evil god that could be persuaded to put a curse on somebody. No, he asked. Your god, he didn't put a curse on Tata Chobe? This was on a sweltering afternoon as Nelson and I chopped firewood to carry into the kitchen house. It was endless work to feed our cast-iron stove just for boiling the water, let alone cooking. Tata Chobe? I was wary of this conversation, but curious to know how well he'd learned the teachings of the Bible. Through the very large holes in his red T-shirt, I watched the strings of muscle tense up in Nelson's back for one hard second as he raised his machete and split the deep purple heart of a small log. Nelson used his machete for everything under the sun, from splitting kindling to shaving, not that he had a real need at age 13, to cleaning the stove. He kept it extremely sharp and clean. He stood to catch his breath. He laid the machete carefully on the ground and threw his arms in wide circles to loosen them out. Your god put a kibaatsu on Tata Chobe. He gave him the pox and the itches and killed all his 7 children under one roof. Oh, Job, I said. Why, that wasn't a curse, Nelson. God was testing his faith. Abu, Nelson said, meaning more or less, okay, fine. After he'd taken up his weapon again and split three or four more Purple Heart logs, he said, Somebody is testing faith for your mother and your little sister. The next one he will be testing is the termite. Mvula, a pale white termite that comes out after a rain, is what people here call Rachel because she's so pallid. Their opinion is that she gets that way from staying indoors too much and being terrified of life in general. Rachel doesn't think much of termites, needless to say, and insists that the word has some other higher meaning. I am generally called Leba, a much nicer word that means fig tree. At first we thought they couldn't say Leah, but it turns out they can say it perfectly well and are being nice to avoid it because Leah is the Kikongo word for nothing much. I repeated to Nelson that however he might interpret the parable of Job, our family doesn't believe in witch doctor ngangas and evil eye fetishes and the nkisis and the grigris people wear around their necks to ward off curses and the like. I'm sorry, Nelson, I told him, but we just don't worship those gods. To make our position perfectly clear, I added bakave. This means we don't pay for that, which is how you say that you don't believe. Nelson gently stacked wood into my outstretched arms. Abu, he said sorrowfully. I had no choice but to look closely into Nelson's sweat-glazed face as he arranged the wood in my awkward embrace. Our work brought us that close together. I could see that he seemed truly sad for us. He clicked his tongue the way Mama Tataba used to and told me, Leba, the gods you do not pay are the ones that can curse you best. Ada. Wonkton Odu, we do not know. The things we do not know, independently and in unison as a family, would fill two separate baskets, each with a large hole in the bottom. Muntu is the Congolese word for man or people, but it means more than that. Here in the Congo, I am pleased to announce there is no special difference between living people, dead people, children not yet born, and gods. These are all Muntu, so says Nelson. All other things are kintu, animals, stones, bottles. A place or a time is huntu, and a quality of being is kuntu, beautiful, hideous, or lame, for example. All these things have in common the stem word ntu. All that is being here, ntu, says Nelson with a shrug as if this is not so difficult to understand. And it would be simple, except that being here is not the same as existing. He explains the difference this way. The principles of Ntu are asleep until they are touched by Nomo. Nomo is the force that makes things live as what they are, man or tree or animal. Nomo means word. The rabbit has the life it has, not a rat life or a mongoose life, because it is named rabbit, Mvundla. A child is not alive, claims Nelson, until it is named. I told him this helped explain a mystery for me. My sister and I are identical twins, so how is it that from one single seed we have two such different lives? Now I know, because I am named Ada, and she is named Leah. Nomo, I wrote down on the notebook I had opened out for us at our big table. Nomo, Oman, no-mo, I wrote, wishing to learn this word forward and backward. Theoretically, I was in the process of showing Nelson, at his urging, how to write a letter, ignoring the fact he would have no way to mail it. He enjoys my silent tutelage and asks for it often. But Nelson, as a pupil, is apt to turn teacher himself at the least provocation, and he seems to think his chatter improves our conversation since I only write things on paper. Nomo Mvula is my sister Rachel, I queried. He nodded. Ruth May, then, is Nomo Bandu, and Leah is Nomo Leba. And where does Nomo come from? He pointed to his mouth. Nomo comes from the mouth, like water vapor, he said. A song, a poem, a scream, a prayer, a name, all these are nomo. Water itself is nomo, of the most important kind, it turns out. Water is the word of the ancestors given to us or withheld, depending on how well we treat them. The word of the ancestors is pulled into trees and men, Nelson explained, and this allows them to stand and live as muntu. A tree is also muntu, I wrote. Quickly I drew stick man and stick tree side by side to clarify. Our conversations are often mostly pictures and gestures. A tree is a type of person? Of course, Nelson said. Just look at them. They both have roots and a head. Nelson was puzzled by my failure to understand such a simple thing. Then he asked, You and your sister Leba, how do you mean you came from the same seed? Twins, I wrote. He didn't recognize the word. I drew two identical girls side by side, which he found even more baffling, given that Leah and I, the beauty and the beast, were the twins under consideration. So then, since no one was around to watch us and Nelson seems incapable of embarrassment, I brought forth a shameless pantomime of a mother giving birth to one baby, then, oh my, another. Twins. His eyes grew wide. Baza! I nodded, thinking he was not the first to be amazed by this news about Leah and me, but it must have been more than that because he leaped away from me with such haste that he knocked over his chair. Baza? He repeated, pointing at me. He delicately touched my forehead and recoiled as if my skin might burn him. I scribbled with some defensiveness, "You never saw twins?" He shook his head with conviction. "Any woman who has Baza should take the two babies to the forest after they are born and leave them there. She takes them fast right away. That is very, very, very necessary." "Why?" "The ancestors and gods," he stammered. "All gods. What god would not be furious at a mother who kept such babies? I think the whole village would be flooded, or mostly everyone would die if a mother kept her Baza." I looked around the room, saw no immediate evidence of catastrophe, and shrugged. I turned the page on our lesson in business correspondence and began to work on an elaborate pencil drawing of Noah's Ark. After a while, Nelson righted his chair and sat down approximately 4 feet away from me. He leaned very far over to try to peer at my picture. "This is not about twins," I wrote across the top. "Or who knows, maybe it is," I thought, "all those paired-up bunnies and elephants. What happened to your village when your mother did not take you to the forest?" I considered the year of our birth and wrote, "We won the war." Then I proceeded to draw the outline of an exceptionally elegant giraffe. But Nelson glowered, still waiting for evidence that my birth had not brought down a plague upon my house. "No floods, no epidemics," I wrote. "All is well in USA, where mothers keep their baza every day." Nelson stared at me with such pure, annoyed skepticism I was tempted to doubt my own word. Hadn't there been, say, a rash of hurricanes in the months after Leah and I were born? A bad winter nationwide for the flu? Who knew? I shrugged and drew a second giraffe with a dramatic Z-shaped crook to its neck. The Benduka giraffe. Nelson was not going to let me off. Clearly my twinhood was a danger to society. "Tata Jesus, what does he say?" "Too much, as a rule." "What does he say to do when a woman has..." He hesitated over even saying the word in English. I shrugged, but Nelson kept pushing me on this point. He would not believe that the Jesus Bible, with its absolutely prodigious abundance of words, gave no specific instructions to mothers of newborn twins. Finally, I wrote, "Jesus says to keep them, I guess." Nelson became agitated again. "So you see, both wives of Tata Bwanda go to the Jesus Church, and the Mama Lakunga, all these women and their friends and husbands. They think they will have twins again, and Tata Jesus will not make them leave the babies in the forest." This was fascinating news, and I queried him on the particulars. According to Nelson's accounting, nearly half my father's congregations were relatives of dead twins. It is an interesting precept on which to found a ministry, the First Evangelical Baptist Church of the Twin Prone. I also learned from Nelson that we are hosting 7 lepers every Sunday, plus 2 men who have done the thing that is permanently unforgiven by local gods, that is, to have accidentally killed a clansman or a child. We seem to be the church for the lost of cause, which is probably not so far afield from what Jesus himself was operating in his time. This should not have been a great surprise. Anatole had already tried to explain to us the societal function of our church during that fateful dinner that ended in a shattered plate. But the Reverend feels he is doing such a ripping job of clarifying all fine points of the scripture to the heathen, he cannot imagine that he is still merely serving the purpose of cleaning up the streets, as it were, removing troublesome elements from the main ceremonial life of Kilanga. The Reverend failed to notice that every church-going family whose children were struck hard with the kakakaka quietly removed themselves back to ancestor worship, while a few of the heathen families that were hard hit quietly came and tried out Christianity. While it makes perfect sense to me, this pragmatic view of religion escapes the Reverend utterly. Each time a new convert limps through the door on a Sunday morning, he will boast over dinner that he is really calling them home now, buddy, finally attracting the attention of some of the local big shots. And so he continues ministering to the lepers and outcasts. By pure mistake, his implementation is sometimes more pure than his intentions. But mostly it is the other way around. Mostly he shouts, "Praise be," while the back of his hand knocks you flat. How did he come to pass, this Nomo Nathan Price? I do wonder. In the beginning was the Word, the war, the way of all flesh, the mother, the father, the son who was not, the daughters who were too many, the twins who brought down the house indeed. In the beginning was the Word, the herd, the blurred, the turd, the debts incurred, the theatrical absurd. Our Father has a bone to pick with this world, and oh, he picks it like a sore, picks it with the Word. His punishment is the word, and his deficiencies are failures of words. As when he grows impatient with translation and strikes out precariously on his own, telling parables in his wildly half-baked Kikongo. It is a dangerous thing, I now understand, to make mistakes with Nomo in the Congo. If you assign the wrong names to things, you could make a chicken speak like a man, make a machete rise up and dance. We, his daughters and wife, are not innocent either. The players in his theater. We Prices are altogether thought to be peculiarly well-intentioned and inane. I know this. Nelson would never come out.